The book fair market is at least a half a billion dollar market. The book fair market in California, I would estimate to be 50 million. So we can get up to 10 or 20 million in revenue without even taking over more than 50% of our market.
Welcome to Shopify Masters, your companion for starting and building a business. I'm your host, Serena Smith. When Stephanie and Mumar Reed couldn't find children's books that reflected their daughter's multicultural world, they decided to write their own next chapter. In 2020, they launched Miha Books, a company bringing diverse stories and authors to the forefront. What started as a blog has grown into pop-ups, a brick-and-mortar store, and now a thriving school book fair model.
I grew up with school book fairs, but I never made the connection that, oh, we can do that too. And so we did that at their school.
Along the way, Miha Books has sold over 60,000 books, hosted nearly 200 school book fairs, and is on track to reach close to $1 million in annual revenue this year.
We made more in those 2 hours than we did in an entire week at the store.
Here to share how they're rewriting the story of what a modern book business can be, Stephanie and Mo Reed. Welcome to the show, you guys.
Hey.
Thanks for having us.
Business co-owners, husband and wife duo. You are enmeshed in all the ways, which we will talk about. But I want to go back a little bit because neither of you are booksellers by trade. Mo, you're a lawyer. And Stephanie, you were working with seniors for many years. So why, especially in a moment when it feels like books in so many ways can feel sort of quaint and antiquated, why make the pivot to books?
Yeah, so for us, it was kind of built out of a necessity during the pandemic. My senior business, you mentioned that was my first business, was greatly affected by the pandemic. As you all might remember, you know, senior facilities and working with seniors, it was almost like completely off guard unless you were staff. Even family couldn't visit seniors in a retirement home. So at the height of the pandemic, that business came to a halt. And at the time, our daughter was turning one. And as you mentioned, she's multicultural. You know, my husband's Black, I'm Latina. And just out of a hobby, we started building a home library for her. Even before she was born, I started collecting books knowing that they were going to be for my future children. So we were building a home library. And during that time, we just struggled to find books that were in Spanish, books that were representative of the world around her, you know, multicultural stories, books that had characters that looked like her. And we found it really frustrating that we had to struggle to find those books, you know, even online, searching through endless page after page before we found something that we resonated with. And so when I realized that my senior business was most likely not going to ever reach the same level that I was before the pandemic, I realized that I needed to pivot to something else that would be financially feasible for me. And so this hobby that we developed building her home library turned into what is now Miha Books. So that's where the pivot came. And like you said, we weren't booksellers before, but it was a passion of ours that turned into business.
Yeah. And your business has followed, I mean, in the founder startup world, I don't know if there is a conventional trajectory, but yours is unconventional in that you've pivoted several times. Started out as a review website, making recommendations, then you went into e-commerce, then you started doing pop-ups, right? Then you had the opportunity to have brick and mortar retail. And now, which we'll talk all about, you're primarily focused on book fairs. Can you talk a little bit about why you made each of those shifts?
Yeah, I mean, so during the pandemic, we couldn't go anywhere, right? So we were kind of forced to try to build something during the shutdown. And so the easy place to start was putting up a website. So that's what we built initially. We built a brand logo and you know, an image around our name, which is really special to us since it's our daughter's initials. And it also means my daughter in Spanish, right? The colloquial word for my daughter. And then, as I said, when I realized my first business, I wasn't able to make money from that. We had to turn the book idea into something that was financially viable. So with the next easy place to go when you have a website is to make it an e-commerce website. And so I opened up accounts with publishers and made connections with local authors and indie pubs just through social media and started selling some of the books that we recommended. And then from there, you know, once the COVID restrictions started lifting and people were getting out more, we noticed a lot of small business markets that were happening in and around Los Angeles. So we got connected with some organizations that were putting those on a few times a month and started doing those markets. And we did pretty well at some of them. You know, living the pop-up market life is another beast. We realized really quickly that you have to be very careful about how you choose which markets to attend. You know, the audience size, the location, all matters. So we did that for a couple years as just like the primary way of us selling books. But it's grueling. You can make money on some, but oftentimes you're breaking even or even losing money on those markets. So that was rough. And then from there, this opportunity to have a brick and mortar came about. We just walking the mall and seeing a lot of empty storefronts and the opportunity for one that said having a pop-up. And we realized, you know, we started growing a following on social media. So, you know, we gained some traction for our brand and what we were doing at the time. And we signed a 3-month pop-up lease in the mall. And it was November, December, January.
Of what year?
So November 2021 through the 3 months. So January 2022. But then that turned into another 12 months at that mall. So in total, we did 15 months for brick and mortar from November 21 through January 23. And that is a whole nother beast in and of itself. We definitely... Yeah.
I would say that that was our biggest mistake, because that was probably a 6-figure mistake. We should have just stayed for 3 months and then went back to our e-commerce model or whatnot. But unless you have a high AOV product store, I just don't think brick and mortar works for anyone. You better be selling Louis Vuitton bags, jewelry, something where each item you're selling at a clip of $1,000, $2,000, or you need extremely high volume to make brick and mortar work nowadays.
Yeah, and that's the reason why people are walking into malls, right? They want the anchor stores, you know, the Macy's, and the stores that have 3,000, 4,000 square feet. So it's really hard to be a mom and pop store inside of a mall in particular. The 3 months of the pop-up lease is a much more viable option because you're getting holiday foot traffic. We did really, really well in those 3 months. We were like, oh, this is great. Let's do a full year, right? But we realized really quickly how much of a difference the holiday traffic is compared to just the rest of the year. And so that's a model that we don't want to go back to.
And not having ever experienced that prior, you didn't really have any frame of reference to understand, oh, our sales may tank after these 3 months. And then you're locked into a full year that you can't get out of. So can you take me into the texture and the specifics of that year a little bit more and what was going on?
Yes.
In the brick and mortar of it all?
Right. Yeah. And I also do want to say, though, that he said, you know, having a brick and mortar was a mistake. I think he meant having that long-term brick and mortar, because the one positive thing that came out of that was the exposure. So we received press from the Los Angeles Times. We were voted one of the 65 best bookstores in LA. And a lot of customers came in because of that article. We were featured in Spectrum News, KTLA 5, NBC 4. They all did spots at our store. And that brought in some foot traffic. Not enough throughout the year for it to make sense financially, but we now have all of those markers that we can put on our website, right? As seen on, you know, the social proof, right? Now we have that because of the brick and mortar. So essentially it was a huge billboard that we paid for, right? So that was the positive. But yes, throughout the year, I mean, sales tank almost literally the day after Christmas. You see the numbers go way down, and it's not enough to reach rent and payroll at that point, right? To keep the lights on. So for bookstores in particular, the one thing that we do have is the ability to put on events because of our connections with authors. You know, story times are a big deal. Kids events, they attract a lot of people. The thing with events is they're a lot of work. A lot of bookstores that you see, indie bookstores, you'll see they have a huge calendar of events because those are the money-making days. So essentially, you'd have to have an event every single day for the financials to make sense.
The reason why I call it a mistake, though, is because from a tactical standpoint, from a small business, if you're getting a brick and mortar or a brick and mortar at a mall, I almost think it needs to be a marketing line item rather than it being like something that you're intending to make money from. If it is a billboard, you need to put it on your balance sheet as like a billboard cost. So, for instance, we are actually going back to the Lakewood Mall this holiday season for just about a month or so. And yes, we want to make money there, but the main reason for us doing that is because we want to sign up more book fairs, and we know it is a billboard. So it's not just like a way to make more money versus like, it's more of an advertising and marketing cost. Because our AOV, the average order we would get was between like $25 and $30. And to acquire a customer that's only paying $25 to $30, like you might just break even. But if you are anticipating that, that's one thing. If you are using that for growth or thinking that this is going to be the thing that pushes your business into the stratosphere, from a profit standpoint, unless you have massive volume, that's just not going to be the case. And then number three, a lot of small business owners need to know that a lot of these mall contracts, once you hit a certain number, they actually want to participate in your revenue. So
percentage of sales after a certain amount.
Yeah, if you hit 20,000 or 30,000 or whatever that number is in your contract, then the mall wants 20 to 30% of that on top of your monthly cost.
Yeah, and that number is negotiable, but they're going to then increase your monthly rent. You know, they can increase or decrease your monthly rent, and then they'll increase or decrease the amount percentage that they'll take, and then the threshold number as well. So there's a lot of figuring out what makes sense, which is difficult if you've never had a brick and mortar.
Is there something specific about the mall model that is particularly problematic here versus just brick and mortar generally?
We haven't really checked out standard brick and mortar to see if they have similar contracts, but the mall traffic, that's the reason why we're there. There's just more people going to a mall that you didn't necessarily need to advertise for versus a standard shopping center. You need to drag them there. If you're not dragging people there, if your ads, then no one's showing up to your shopping center location. So I would assume that that's the difference. You really need to be heavily marketing your store consistently to bring people in. Or for me, it's just not worth it. Like I just don't think the juice is worth the squeeze unless you're selling something where your average order is at like hundreds of dollars to $1,000 or more.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. When your average order is that low, you have to do so much volume for it to make sense. Okay. And so you learned some very important, it sounds like quite expensive lessons from that period of time. And now you're going back this year, but just for the holiday season, because you know that the juice is worth the squeeze there.
Right.
How did book fairs come into your purview?
So we had a lot of teachers, principals, parents, obviously, that came through the door. But it was one parent in particular who was a PTA parent at an elementary school that was near our store. And, you know, she loved what we were doing. And she came up to me, approached me and said, "Have you all ever thought about coming to schools, or do you come to schools?" And that was never in my, you know, realm of possibilities for us. I grew up with school book fairs, but I never made the connection that, oh, we can do that too, right? And so after she, you know, planted that idea, I said, "You know what? Why not? We've done mobile bookstores before, right? When we were doing the small markets, sort of the same thing, just in a private setting." And so we did that at their school. It was for, I think, a fall festival, and it was 2 hours of sales. We made more in those 2 hours than we did in an entire week at the store. And so that was the entire, you know, that was the light bulb moment, so to speak. And so it was a customer in our brick and mortar that inspired us to now, you know, pivot again and do what we're doing now, is essentially the Scholastic alternative and offering week-long school book fairs.
Serendipity.
Right.
Yeah.
That was your eureka moment. And it's like, you know, if you hadn't had that brick and mortar, would that moment have occurred for you guys, you know?
Yes. Or would we be trying to scale our online e-commerce versus the book fairs at school? And I think more than anything else, it's like having a starving audience. So when people are going into a mall, they're not there for you. They're there to eat. They're there for the big chain stores, and they might happen to happen by you. When people are going to a book fair at their kid's school, we're not competing with anyone. We're the only ones there selling. Every teacher is saying, "Hey, little Johnny probably needs some books." You know, if you see little Johnny's friends getting two or three books, you're like, you know, it's a competitive thing between parents. Like, well, you know, they're not going to read better than my kid. It's a better environment to capture almost the entire market rather than people not being there for you.
I remember being so stoked for book fairs when I was a kid. It's like an event in your life, you know,
right,
as a child.
Right. We've noticed that promotion at schools varies a lot, and some schools are really, really do a really good job of promoting. And I mean, the whole point of a book fair should be promoting the love of literacy, right? You know, you get kids excited about books and getting to choose their own books, getting to look at through the books and pick what they want to read and what they want to own, right? And a lot of the time during that week, they also have authors come and visit the school and just have this whole environment of literacy. So it, like my husband said, it's just the perfect place to capture our target market, right? All of our avatars, which is children, parents, teachers, and other school staff.
How much of your mix is book fairs at this point?
90-95%.
Yeah, I'd say it's about at least 95%. We promote our e-commerce through the school book fairs as well. So a lot of the online orders that we're currently getting are because we're hosting school book fairs. We recently transitioned over to Shopify from WooCommerce, and we haven't even announced that we have a new website to the general public. So we have a lot of growth there on that side just for D2C e-commerce. But right now we're so in the thick of our school book fairs and trying to get that down as, you know, a well-oiled machine, because there's still a lot to improve on that end as far as the operations and logistics go. So there's a lot of growth still for D2C on our e-commerce side for sure.
And I kind of look at that as like our superpower. So we see some of our competitors. The only ones that's focused is Scholastic, or I like to call them the old guys, right? Like, they're the only ones that are focused primarily on just book fairs. They have a couple of other verticals as well. But we see some of the smaller competitors that may do something somewhat similar to us. They can't scale because they don't realize that their brick and mortar bookstore and the book fair business and the e-commerce business are all three completely separate businesses. They require completely separate skill sets for all three. And if you're focused on three and one company is focused on one, it's going to be hard for you to beat them in that particular space. And from the e-commerce side, that once again, if our average order value is $25 to $30, that means I need to acquire a customer on Facebook ads or Google ads for less than that, when our AOV for a fair is $5,000 to $6,000. So acquiring a fair, we can spend more money to acquire a fair than we can acquiring a book order or a book purchase customer, at least just one. So I almost look at book fairs as like a big bundle for us that ends up being a $5,000 to $6,000 order.
Book fairs is big business. Who knew it?
And we had another big unlock specifically with the book fairs. I would say after year one, we realized that schools with more students end up making more money. So we target schools, elementary schools with higher student populations, because we get more transactions, which tends to make sense. And then at first we were allowing people to book fairs for 3 days. Then it was a minimum of 4 days, and then it was a minimum of 5 days, and we were able to increase revenue by making schools have fairs for longer. That increased our revenue by 20 to 25% and increased our margins. So yeah, just some things that we are figuring out.
These three avatars, how did you land on what the three of them are, and how do you approach your marketing to each of them?
So there were two ladies that walked into our brick and mortar that loved what we were doing and decided to start giving away $200 worth of books every month.
No, so that's not how it happened. So they walked in, they walked in, and that actually, those ladies came from our LA Times article. So they were on a crawl to visit as many of the 65 bookstores that LA Times highlighted as possible. And we were one of the stores, you know, on the stop. And they came in and were like, man, this is so amazing. You know, we're so glad that we came to the store. And, you know, they made a purchase. And I believe it was on a return purchase. It wasn't that first time. They came back to support again during the holidays. And she was like, we just love what you're doing. And we don't have any kids. And so the books that they bought, they were just going to donate them. But they're like, we just want to support you. And she handed me an envelope with $200 inside. And Actually, the first time it was $1,000. It was $1,000. And she said, we just want to support you. You can use this however is best for you for and your store. And we were doing a lot of giveaways on our social media to gain followers. And so I said, why don't we use this money to create book bundles and give those away to parents and teachers that follow us? And so with that money, I created bundles. And then the ladies that initially gave us that donation, follow us on social media, saw that we were doing that and gave us another $1,000. And so they're like, we love that you're doing this every month. That's so amazing, right? They saw where their money was going directly. And so they kept supporting us that way. And through all of these giveaways we were doing every month, we had a newsletter that we were growing. And so part of the criteria was to enter our newsletter and follow us on social media. And we saw that that was working to increase newsletter subscribers and to increase social media followers. And so that's where we kept going. Yeah.
That was a huge unlock.
Yeah.
Right. And so if I had a tactical piece of business advice for new business owners, give away something for free if you can. And it doesn't need to be to everyone, but a chance to win something free. It's worked so well that I started doing it for my law firm as well. If you give away something for free, people will give you information. And from a lot of that information, figuring out who was submitting, doing different giveaways, and then getting book fair submissions, what we found were those three avatars were the ones that were booking fairs the most. And so that's how we dialed that in. We've been running giveaways for about 2 years now. And if you go look at the thousands of people who have submitted for fairs, you see three things consistently. You see PTA members, you see principals, vice principals, assistant principals, and you see librarians, librarian aides, librarian assistants, and then even teachers. Teachers are like a connector. So Stephanie was talking to me the other day about a principal called us, and just looking at her customer journey for booking a fair, it was a teacher who entered our giveaway from our newsletter, and then she forwarded that information to the principal, and then the principal got one of our ads and decided to book a fair from there. So teacher is more of a connector to our avatar rather than our direct avatar.
And what are the programs or the steps that you're utilizing to take somebody from the giveaway step to the booking, the book fair step?
Oh, Lord.
Take us through
a lot of subscriptions.
So Zapier. I don't work for Zapier or anything.
We're keeping them in business. Let's say that.
Zapier or Make, which is their biggest competitor, they pretty much do the same thing. I have friends that use one or the other, right? Pretty much the same thing, if you ask me. Let's start from the giveaway. Someone will get an ad or a post on our Instagram page that indicates, hey, this is our monthly giveaway. They go to our landing page. From our landing page, they fill out information related to who they are, what's their school, that sort of thing. Then once they submit, they get a text message with a link to Book a Fair. They get an email and they start our email journey through, we use MailChimp, a lot of other platforms out there, but they get an email saying, thank you for entering our giveaway. Hey, we book book fairs. Here's a link to our book fair submission page. Also, do you know anyone that might be interested in book fairs, or forward this to someone that might be interested in book fairs? And then from there, we do about 3 to 5 emails a week. I even break it down on Mondays. We do teacher parent tips or events in the area. On Tuesday, it's our PTA giveaway. On Wednesday, it's our teacher giveaway. On Thursday, it's our Title I newsletter to give people information about how to use their Title I for schools. And on Friday, it's like pure, hey, book our book fair. But there are links and CTAs throughout every single email to get people to our book fair landing page. So that's generally how we take people from giveaway to trying to get them to book a fair.
Okay, so you are not just relying on word of mouth. You've got a full funnel going on here. And it sounds like the automation piece of this is also pretty critical for you. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Or we would need to hire a bunch of people. to have all of those touch points. Yeah.
Yeah.
Was there a period in the beginning where you were sort of doing it all by hand? You were the elves behind it all?
Yes. And that was a challenge because I'm also wearing all the other hats in the business. So we soon realized, like, wait a minute, in order to hit people right away, you know, once a lead comes through, this needs to be automatic. And with everything else I had going on, I told my husband, we need to solve this. It's not working. And so he's the one that installed all of those, the automation side of it, so that I didn't have to think about it because I was doing everything manually. You know, it was a lot.
You also, it sounds like, have a pretty robust content engine that's going on. You're sending out 3 newsletters a week. That's not an insignificant amount of work. That could be a full-time job in and of itself. How are you making that work alongside actually running the book fairs and Mo, you also being a lawyer who shoots music videos in your spare time and you're parenting children?
So I have a great marketing assistant that works for a few of my businesses. And so for us, a tactical tip for business owners that are like, I don't have time to film or do content or newsletters. You got to batch your content, number one. So find a time on the weekend. Don't shoot one video, shoot 20, which means there's a lot of prep that goes into that. So me and my marketing assistant, who's also my little cousin, shout out to Devoria. We have days and mornings where we will spend a couple of hours planning our content, even if we're going to shoot it and it might take 2 or 3 hours to shoot. But if you plan it out before shooting content is easier. It doesn't take 5 hours if you know what all your hooks are, what social proof you're going to put in the video, what the content's going to be, and then what your CTA is going to be. And then we shoot them modularly so that we can mix and match videos with content, with different CTAs, with different hooks and that sort of thing. So I'll give you an example from my firm the other day. I maybe spent about an hour filming, and out of that, we're getting about 72 videos. So you got to try and figure whatever that is out for your business. And then I use Adobe Premiere Pro. But if you use Final Cut, Premiere Pro, DaVinci, CapCut, whatever it is, or whatever AI software, take the captions from your video, feed that into a ChatGPT, a Claude, or a Gemini, and then have it write newsletters and post based upon your content. And then it's your authentic voice because it's trained off of your video and your content. And so it's going to sound like you. But you could say, hey, ChatGPT, make this into a carousel post for me. Make this into a newsletter for me, right? These are the 3 videos that are performing the best on ads. Can you change the hook a little bit or change the content a little bit? And then let's film 3 or 4 more videos or give me scripts that relate to that. So that way, like now with AI, there's no excuse for you not to be able to turn one piece of content into 4 or 5 other posts on different platforms, right?
Mm. Something that jumps out to me about what you're talking about is like there is still very much the bespoke, you're doing it yourself component to this. And then you're also wielding AI to sort of repackage your content and have it get more mileage than it would otherwise. Does that sound right?
Yeah. Yeah, or I'm trying to get Stephanie to do more of just documenting what you're doing every day. So if we have a big bulk order coming in, that's a $60,000 order, like just video packaging the stuff up, right?
We have a lot of room there to use that type of BTS content, right? When we're, because it does well when we've done it, posted that in the past. So it's just having that set up in our warehouse, you know, because we have the studio where we record all of the pre-recorded stuff, the batch shooting. So having that set up in the warehouse is what would make that easier for me to just go and turn something on to record versus me taking the time every single day I'm in the warehouse to set everything up and prepare everything and then record, because I'm always on a really tight schedule at the warehouse. So if I need to have that set up where I can just, you know, press the on button and then go about what I needed to do. But that's another aspect of the marketing. Yeah, people like to see the BTS.
Yeah, you got to make it turnkey for yourself so that it's effortless. The barrier is low. I mean, take us into the BTS. Book fairs sound deceptively simple. You show up, you sell the books. But I would imagine from an operational perspective and logistically, there's a lot going on behind the scenes.
Yes, yes. So we started the book fairs from the brick and mortar. So yeah, logistically, having to prepare for them is difficult because you're sending so many SKUs at once. You know, if it was one product, a small handful of products, that wouldn't be a big deal. But the whole point at a book fair is essentially you're setting up a mini store for a week, right? And so like with any store, you want to walk in and see a bunch of products for you to choose from. And so with us, right now, we're sending about 300 SKUs for every school. And so having to prepare and pack those is very time consuming. We're trying to get some systems down to where right now, every single fair in the same season has the exact same SKUs. And that's something that I had to learn the hard way because we were doing every school previously was had its own set of SKUs based off of what I had in stock at the time, you know, how many book fairs we had going out in a single week. You know, once we closed our brick and mortar, everything was operating out of our garage. And so having to deal with that. We also learned very quickly once we started growing our school book fair business that having a standard garage square footage was not working out. I had to deal with rain. You know, luckily we were in California. We didn't have all of the other snow and other elements, but just the rain days and having to work outside of the garage and throw up tents and you know, try to protect all of the product from the rain, that was a whole nother ordeal. So I realized really quickly that we needed a full-fledged warehouse for this operation because you need the staffing to scan everything, pack it. You know, you need to know the quantities that's going out to every school. So the logistics of trying to keep everything trackable, that is what takes time and needs to be fleshed out before, you know, you can just send everything off. And then the delivery aspect of it. Initially, I was doing all of the deliveries myself out of my Honda HRV, taking all of the thousands of products that we were doing for every school book fair. And I was operating part of the registers at the first schools that we did. And then as that started to grow, we quickly realized, well, I can't be in 20 schools at the same time. And I can't have 20 deliveries happen out of my HRV. So I think we need to figure out how to handle the delivery aspect of it, right? So now we have a contracted drivers that use Sprinter vans to send off our school book fairs, right? So yeah, there's so many elements, so many pieces to that.
And while she's freaking out, like, I'm like, oh my God, this is great. We're breaking things, you know?
Yeah, we're breaking systems. Yeah.
Well, and that's what growth is, right? Because if you're growing and you start getting more customers, something is going to break operationally. And then you need to fix that operational break in order to keep growing. But for me, that's a sign of growth. The fact that our garage is packed full of stuff and we can't fit any more books in there because we have so much business. I'm like, great, you know? And same thing with the warehouse. Last March, we broke it again where we booked too many fairs. And then we had this big delivery issue where we had to cancel some fairs, unfortunately, but we just had too many books in the warehouse to like fulfill, like we couldn't fit any more books in our warehouse the way it was set up at the time. And so once again, she's freaking out and I'm like, great, because it's just the next problem to fix. We went from a garage. We filled that up. Now we went to a bigger warehouse and we filled that up. It might need some more space. That means we're growing, which is what I call a good problem to have. I would rather have a problem of we have too many fairs and not enough space than there's no one calling us. Yeah.
Mo, you're speaking to something that's so essential, which is a growth mindset, right? Versus a fixed mindset. Do you have any advice in terms of how founders can see those problems, not as problems, but as opportunities?
Yeah. So generally, the first problem that every business has is leads. How do I get people to book my service or buy my products? And then once you fix that, you probably have a leaky bucket, means you're not converting enough of your leads, which means there's something wrong with your sales motion. You're not contacting your leads fast enough, right? If you don't have enough margin, you have a price problem. And you need to increase your price. Or in our case, we didn't increase our price. We just stopped selling $25 to $30 purchases. And now we're selling fares that are $5,000 to $6,000 that we get. If people aren't rebooking with us, then we need to talk to our customers and figure out why. Why did they reach out to us? What went wrong? Why they don't want to rebook with us so that we can have reoccurring revenue, because we don't really have a subscription product. So that's the framework that I think of business. And at any given time, one of those things is going to break and you need to fix it and focus on that particular quadrant at that particular time. So that's just kind of how I think of things from a growth standpoint. Yeah.
I love it. That's really valuable stuff. I mean, I think, you know, this story is such an important lesson in a willingness to pivot and to be able to see the writing on the wall, and also to know to take good advice from other people when it's being presented to you, to have the humility to say, that's a good idea and maybe we should lean into this, you know? Miha Books has found a real sweet spot in book fairs in Southern California. Where is it going from here?
Yeah, I mean, we keep getting requests for out-of-state book fairs, even overseas. And right now, the issue with servicing out-of-state is the delivery cost. And so that's the next issue that we have to try and figure out how to overcome, that because we can't afford that increased delivery cost. That's the downside with books, is they're so heavy in bulk, right? And so they cost a ton to transport. We've had some schools that are willing to pay for that transportation fee. And we're actually doing an online book fair in New Jersey. And they want us to send just like sample products for them to put on display at the school. So that's a small way for us to start experimenting with expansion. But that's the biggest hurdle right now, honestly, is how to actually get 300 SKUs, and we're sending like at least 10K worth of retail inventory over to schools. So that's what we hope is to expand into other markets. But that also means we need other warehouse nodes to make it logistically easier for delivery. We would need other nodes across the country, which is how other national school book fair providers operate. So that's the expansion. And then we also had a lot of requests for subscriptions, you know, people that don't want to do the work of trying to find their own books and bundles. So there's a lot of opportunity for us there to just build bundles for people and either offer subscriptions or offer bundle product packages on our website. Those are the first things that we're working on.
And I would rather go deeper than wider. We happen to be in the best place in the country for our products specifically. And the book fair market is at least a $500 million market. The book fair market in California, I would estimate to be 50 million. And so we can get up to 10 or 20 million in revenue without even taking over more than 50% of our market where we are, because we just happen to be in the most diverse area in the country. So instead of trying to expand into different verticals, I would rather just try to book more fairs where we are, get more reoccurring bookings without having to pay the cost of reacquiring the same customers that we have until we get to about 50% saturation in Southern California. And I think that's the move right now, intermediately. And then once we get there, then we can start thinking about adding a separate vertical or going to NorCal, going to like Dallas County, or just scaling our online book fair model, because that's easier to scale, but the margins are a little bit lower. Yes.
And that's how you can capture the national market, is via e-commerce, if you're not going to be boots on the ground. I mean, I got to say, it's a pretty incredible thing to hear the two of you talking about this. This whole thing started, the genesis of the idea was because there was, by your own admission, a dearth of these kinds of books, and being able to find them was really difficult, which, you know, if nothing else, is a sad thing as parents of a multicultural child. And now you're talking about like an abundance of SKUs and more than you know what to do with, you know? It's like, it's pretty amazing to see that the landscape has shifted that much, even within this short period of time, you know, 5 years.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there was a study that was done by, it's a university in Wisconsin that's the leading research center for representation in children's books in particular. And there's been slight progress since 2020, like literally 1 or 2 percentage points of representation in, you know, the Black, Latino, Asian, you know, Indigenous representation, but not enough for you to be able to see these books just in any store that you walk into, right? These books exist, but part of the problem as well is that the big publishers don't want to put their dollars behind the marketing of BIPOC authors and BIPOC stories. It's still very uneven in that respect as well. There's also another study that was done to talk about the overwhelmingly white representation of agents and publishers and, you know, publishing owners. So the people making the decisions to buy these manuscripts and even just have them out there in the world is a problem. So that there's still a huge, huge issue on that respect. And so we're trying to do our best to amplify as many of the BIPOC voices that are out there and are getting deals. That's the progress that we've made.
And then one of the problems has actually become a superpower of ours. Everyone loves our book selection. And one of the big complaints against the old guys is that they keep bringing the same thing. But because they don't print as many Black and Brown books, we always have to find new books, which means our selection is always generally pretty fresh, because even some of the books that we sell out of that we would love to reorder, they go out of print, because they just don't print as many copies. So we would love to make some of those books bestsellers, but because they don't print as many copies, we continuously have to just keep refreshing our inventory, which means that we can keep providing new books every single year, you know?
Mo, Stephanie, appreciate you both for doing this work. Thank you so much for joining us today. It was a delight.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
Thank you.
That's Stephanie and Mo Reed, founders of Miha Books. Shopify Masters is produced by Alicia Clark, Gogo Zoger, and Shuang Esther Shan. Our engineers are Matt Schwartz and Miku Betlem, and Rachel Raich is our senior content lead. And I'm your host, Serena Smith. Come back every Tuesday and Thursday to catch a brand new episode of Shopify Masters. Until next time.